Hello and welcome to the HSJ Health Check podcast. My name's Ben Clover. I'm one of the bureau chiefs here at the HSJ, and we have a crack team assembled for you today to take you through some of the big stories the HSJ has been reporting this week. Obviously, at the time this podcast is recorded, which is a Wednesday afternoon, we're just before the longest ever junior doctor strike, a 5-day junior doctor strike, taking in the whole of the weekend for the first time. So this is obviously a huge operational concern for everyone involved in services employing junior doctors at this point. So one of the stories we're going to talk about has some bearing on that. And obviously one of the things that concerns people in every strike of clinical staff is the hit to the amount of work that can be done, but also to the quality of that work. And traditionally, kind of quality is not something the NHS has been very good at measuring the outputs of. However, there are some systems for it, and that brings us to our first story we're going to cover this week. My colleague Matt Discombe has been reporting on North East Ambulance Services, FT's, inquiry into how deaths were reported. So obviously the ambulance trusts all across the country deal with a lot of fatalities, and there have to be quite good systems in place for reporting what's gone wrong and whether it needs to go to be investigated by the trust itself or then by the coroner. So Matt, I wonder if you could take us through where this story's up to with North East Ambulance Service.
Sure. So just going back, there have been some allegations made by a number of whistleblowers and families that North East Ambulance Service was withholding key details on a number of deaths, and therefore, you know, following a story in the Sunday Times last year, HSE have commissioned a review into looking at the coronial processes in this trust. And this report has been published today. When I say today, I mean Wednesday. As I'll explain a bit more about this in a minute, but there's been some doubt about the from the whistleblowers and the families about the scope of this investigation. It's been said that there's around 90, there could be up to 90 cases where there have been issues with disclosures made to coroners, but this report only looks at four particular cases. And this is in a 12-month period up to 2019. But what the report has found is that the ambulance service did indeed delay telling coroners about key concerns and care failings, and such as, you know, omitting key details from reports, ordering initial reports to be changed before eventually disclosing them later on. Just to give you a couple of examples, one of the cases which the report looked at was that of 17-year-old Quinn Beadle, who very sadly took her own life in December 2018, referred to in a report as patient A, but it's her, and the mother has spoken to more of what she's had to say in a moment. But anyway, in the case of Quinn Beadle, there was an initial review which found the first paramedic on the scene didn't attempt what is reported as full advanced life supports, declaring Quinn's death prematurely. The initial report said that this life support should have been attempted, and now the paramedic in question, Gavin Wood, has since been struck off. What's happened to this initial report? Well, that was directed to be altered by what's known as a strategy group in the ambulance service, who disagreed with the outcome that the life support should have been offered, and therefore that detail wasn't shared with the family or coroner in a manner in which the ambulance trust was obliged to do so. And in fact, it was the police professional standards body which informed the coroner of these concerns, not the ambulance trust itself. In another, there was another case as well, in which a man with a COPD, his oxygen supply had failed as a crew, and there were a number of delays, including that the crew stopped unnecessarily. It turned out to refuel the ambulance. Now, although the incident was responded to within national guidelines, the family have said he could have survived if the man had been reached sooner by the ambulance crews. And again, there was a statement to this raising concerns about these delays, but this was again ordered to be changed to omit any details of these delays. In all cases, the information was eventually reached to coroners, but that came too late. And this is what the review concluded. It also talks about that many of the people in charge at the time have been moved on. But the report does criticise what it calls a leadership dysfunction being allowed to continue for too long at NIAS, in which defensiveness grew and affected team operations, transparency, candour and judgment. So as you can maybe expect, the Ambulance Trust, after such a I suppose damning report, has apologised profusely to the families through a statement. Although the report does criticise how it's handled the family's complaints and concerns, it has issued an apology, and it says it's going to act on all the recommendations of the report, which include building in some more independence in terms of how it reports deaths to coroners. So that's I think where we're at with that report, I'd say.
Yeah, it's really shocking, really, that you would have what should be a quite well-oiled process. You know, kind of Ambulance Trust do a lot of work with obviously people who are in a very bad way, so there's going to be a lot of incidents to report, and you'd imagine it would be quite a smooth and well-worked out process about, all right, well, look, this happened, and this outcome happened, this person died, or whatever the case was, is there anything we need to look at? And your own staff kind of go, oh, well, there's the refueling issue, or there's the issue of whether we should have started, you know, the work to save this person a bit earlier. And then this strategy group, which had some quite senior members of a trust sat on the strategy group, they took a decision to remove some information before it goes to the actual lawful process, the coroner's process. I'm a little surprised some are kind of like the duty of candor rules weren't I'm surprised there weren't more rules broken and that more action isn't taken on some of this. But and also, sorry, it covers four cases, this review. Right. Yes. And in two of them it found that information that should have gone to the coroners didn't go to the coroners. But I understand, like, from what you say, Ms. Beadle and others have said, they, in their criticism of the report themselves, they've said it should have covered a wider time frame.
Yes, right? Yes. This concern we reported back in October, I believe. So, one of the main whistleblowers, a man called Paul Calvert, who was he was involved in the process of.
He was the liaison officer between the trust.
And so he refused to take part in the report for a number of reasons, chief of which being that the report scope wasn't far enough. So as I said, it was originally going to look at five cases, but the investigation team couldn't contact one of them, so it eventually looked at four. Now, Mr. Calvert has said that by his estimation, around 90 cases in which disclosures made to coroners should be brought into question deserve to be, you know, investigated by the by their reports, whereas the report itself has just looked at four examples to find, you know, whatever, you know, the systematic issues which I've mentioned. The other bone of contention, I think, with Mrs. Beadle and other whistleblowers is the chair of the of this report is Dame Marianne Griffiths, who used to run Hospital Sussex. Now, recently there's been some concern raised by the Care Quality Commission about the culture of whistleblowing at that trust. And this inspection happened, we should say, just a few months after she left. And so many of the some of the whistleblowers have been raising questions about her suitability to raise to run a review into essentially how, you know, about transparency, openness, and how whistleblowers are treated when there's concerns being raised about her, about the trust she used to run.
I just think it's interesting that kind of like I said at the beginning of the podcast, like it's always surprised me, as long as I've been kind of covering the NHS, how unsophisticated lots of the measures for quality in healthcare are, or certainly how few of them are sort of publicly visible. And the thing that we're always told, kind of, people are most, the bit of accountability that people most fear is being dragged through the coroner's process and having to come and give evidence under oath and all that kind of thing. But what this case suggests, with two of the four cases it looked at finding that information was improperly withheld, is that sort of the gold standard of the justice system looks at processes when something terrible happens, has been sort of undermined, and it appears sort of systematically, like a committee has made a bunch of decisions, at least in this NEAS, Northeast Ambulance Service Trust case, that it shouldn't have done, you know. And it just reminded me of a case I was covering in North East London, where a man died in an inpatient mental health unit, and the coroner said at the end of the case, I don't think the trust's witnesses have been truthful with me, and I don't think I can trust the record keeping that the trust has put in front of me as evidence. And this is another case where actually it took like the police involvement to kind of bring some of those facts forward. But again, there seems to be no recourse. Like, if I was the Ministry of Justice, I'd be wondering, you know, is the coronial process properly taking account of what's going on in the NHS at the moment? Kind of, the Ministry of Justice has been pretty bad at putting out statistics around the coroner's process, because they're often idiosyncratic, like very individual institutions locally based. But anyway, that was my question about that. Thanks for taking us through that, Matt. Now, from a very specific and local case, albeit one with sort of national implications, we're going to talk to my colleagues James Ullman and Henry Anson about a much bigger and, in a way, easier to measure process in the NHS. Kind of, Henry and James broke a really big story today, in fact, about the elective backlog targets, which is one of the Prime Minister's key pledges. So yeah, James, could you take us through what the story was and what it means?
Yeah, sure. So NHS England's made a pretty big intervention this week after deciding it's going to formally water down its target of how much elective activity it targets to carry out this year. So NHS England is it introducing basically one of its most important targets of the year, which was to carry out 107% of value weighted elective activity by 2 percentage points down to 105% of pre-COVID levels. Now, we'll come on to what value-weighted elective activity is a bit later and discuss the financial implications. I'll bring our finance expert, Henry, in to discuss that. But before we kind of delve into the weeds and the nitty-gritty of the finances, I just thought it would be worth assessing the kind of high-level implications of the decision to water down this really key target. Firstly, you know, why are these targets, why is this target being watered down? Well, the primary reason, it will come as no surprise at all to anyone who's been following things in the NHS of late, the primary reason why less elective activity is being carried out is this kind of seemingly never-ending run of industrial action. And the industrial action which has been causing the most cancellations has been the strikes by junior doctors. This all seems very kind of prescient as we're sat on the eve of the junior doctors' longest strike. Now, obviously, the junior doctor strike is a pay dispute. It's very political. And another big political issue is that the PM's big pledge, one of his five major pledges that he's kind of staking his premiership on, is that the NHS waiting list will be falling by next year. So if the NHS now thinks it's going to be able to carry out less elective activity, and remember the waiting list has been rising since the beginning of the year, it's actually been rising since Sunak stood up and said, we're going to have the waiting list falling by next year. It was actually falling for a bit at the back end of last year. But Sunak stood up, made those pledges in his New Year's speech. When he made those pledges, the list has been rising a bit. It's now at about 7.5 million. We'll actually get a more up-to-date figure on Thursday. But if that's rising, then what does this mean for his pledge to have the waiting list falling? Well, it would feel logical to say, well, it's really going to depend on how much industrial action there is. But Steve Barclay, in an interview with us on Monday, rejected this suggestion. He said that, you know, it wasn't a binary choice, and that even if the industrial action kept rolling on, it wouldn't necessarily mean that the Prime Minister's pledge would be missed. But Julian Kelly, who is the Chief Financial Officer at NHS England, he gave a more nuanced answer, and one that will possibly resonate a bit more with trust leaders. So we asked him what strikes meant for the PM's pledge around the waiting list, and he told us, we'll keep looking at where we get to on the total waiting list size. This is going to depend upon what happens in terms of further industrial action. I think that this is one to keep looking at as we look at planning into 24 and 2025. So, you know, an acknowledgement there that there is a risk that if the industrial action keeps on rolling on, well, then, yeah, that's going to have implications for that big, big bold pledge. And it's also, I mean, what's really interesting, and I'm going to bring Henry in a minute here to talk about the finances of this deal that was announced. But the reason we spoke to Mr. Kelly was because he had just been briefing trust finance bosses on how NHS England was going to compensate them for all this lost activity that they'd had during the strikes. Now, the package that's been announced, it's a £350 million bailout package for trusts, and Henry will explain a bit more how that kind of breaks down. But that package is only for April. So there were strikes in April. There were strikes in March, in fact, but they're not factored into this because they were in the last financial year. But then there were strikes in June as well. And now, you know, barring something miraculous happening, there will be more strikes in July. So this £350 million bailout package is only covering the strikes from April. But Henry, I'm going to bring you at this point. First of all, do you want to just take listeners through exactly what we mean when we talk about value-weighted elective activity, and then maybe we can pick a bit more into the financial package that's been put together for trusts to compensate them for the lost activity.
Yes, hello. So there are essentially two types of targets when it comes to electives. Often people talk about the size of the waiting list, and that is the number of, people often say patients. It's the number of sort of entries, number of raw procedures that need to be carried out. But how trusts are actually assessed is on value weighted activity, which basically accounts for the fact that, a sort of very basic follow up appointment can be done relatively simply. It doesn't cost the trust a lot of money compared to, for example, a very complicated operation. So trusts are assessed on what's called value weighted activity targets. And then, I think as James mentioned, they were set initially this year, everyone got set different targets, but they averaged out at 107% nationally. Now, NHS England said at the start of the year that would equate to 115% of pre-COVID levels when you just look at numbers and volume. The relationship is not exactly clear. There's no sort of direct link. But 115%, which was the original volume ambition for this year.
Yeah, our catch-up plan involves us doing 115% of pre-COVID levels, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And it was kind of seen as a logical staging post, because the one of the sort of aims in the elective recovery plan was the health service doing 130% of pre-COVID work by 24-25, the end of 24-25. They were sort of quite careful. It wasn't a specific target, but the thinking was that's the kind of increase on pre-COVID activity that you need to get to in order to achieve all the other waiting times targets. So now we're in a position where the value-based target, which is what trusts are assessed on, has been reduced from 107% of pre-COVID levels down to 105%. As James has kind of mentioned, we've dropped 2 percentage points based on the impact of one strike. It's not difficult to see that further strikes pushing that very close to kind of being the same as what the NHS delivered before the pandemic, and even less. And in that kind of scenario, which is probably the worst case scenario for everyone involved, patients, but also the government, etc. It's very in that scenario, it's very difficult to see the government meeting its waiting time pledge.
Gotcha. And that's what makes it so politically contentious, is that it's an absolutely key thing. Sunak said we'll get a waiting list falling. It's like, no, it might not even be falling. For the benefit of you guys and listeners, just while we've been recording this, the press release from the DH has come through, Steve Barclay expressing regret about the BMA going ahead with overstructuring. So it looks like July is bolted on now, kind of. And sorry, Henry, kind of like can you take us through a bit of the detail on the exactly what the measure of support is for trusts? Trusts are seeing obviously like huge operational impacts of that.
Yes. So in terms of the costs, Julian Kelly kind of talked about the costs of the direct cost of employing consultant cover being around 25 million a day. So 100 million for the 4 days of junior doctor strikes in April. But the whole support package is 350 million. And that kind of gap is accounted for by lost income, basically. So at the start of the year, trusts were asked to deliver a certain amount of elective activity. And the financial plan is underpinned by that goal being hit. Everything else sort of falls into place. So if you fall behind on that, you get deficits emerging, etc. So the bulk of that money is actually to compensate for lost income and the kind of general hit on productivity, because people aren't thinking about savings elective care, etc. They're thinking about how do we get through the strikes, basically. So that's what the money has come out as, the bulk of the money is coming from. The sort of mechanism is basically that ICBs, who are the commissioners, will just be asked to pay trusts as if they had delivered the amount of activity they were meant to have done in the first few months of the year.
Yes, just on like the efficiency, sort of like the opportunity cost. I was speaking to a chief exec a while ago who said, the thing, each time there's a new set of strike dates announced, I then don't see my nursing director for like a month while they go through like the vast amount of detail it takes to kind of go, all right, how are we going to cover all of these rotas? Roughly how many people are going to be off? What services are they going to be? Like what services aren't going to get covered, what are the most safety critical ones we can cover, I remember seeing with the Royal Marsden, so the big cancer specialist in London, so some of their sacked clinics going like, oh, if junior doctors do go off, like no derogations, we'll 80% of those people won't get there, like their cancer treatment. So the only option was, well, we get the agencies in, kind of, we arrange cover any which way. But it's like an immense, I don't think lots of people realize, maybe a lot of our listeners would realize, kind of what an immensely complicated job it is to cover for strikes. And like we said, this is the first 5-dayer, isn't it? And this is the first one over the weekend. And like for getting consultants to cover the juniors while they're off has been a challenge in some places anyway, but this will be the first time it's been over a weekend. James, I just wonder if I could just check I'd understood something about sort of how the government has, how NHS England have sort of pitched the effect of strikes on different parts, on different pledges that have been made, right? Because have I got this right? Kind of, there are targets for eliminating the longest waiters, i.e. people waiting more than a year and a half, people waiting more than a year and a quarter, and it's to get rid of year plus waiters by March 2025, right?
Exactly. The year plus waiters by March 2025. So the next staging post towards that target is the 65-week waiters by March 2024.
Gotcha. And obviously this all falls under the banner of elective stuff, but there's the people waiting a long time target, and then there's the NHS does X much more activity overall target. Right. Now it seems to me like people were on the airwaves saying like, oh well, we might miss some of these long waiters targets because of junior doctor strikes. Am I mistaken?
That was a bit of a red herring thrown in by the health secretary at one point, saying that, oh, that was so in April, the NHS in England was supposed to have got rid of everyone who'd been waiting over 18 months. Now it didn't do this. It just so happened that tied in with a strike, and there was a kind of general narrative being pushed that, oh, if it wasn't for the strike, we'd have hit the target. Well, that wasn't true. At that point, the strikes hadn't bitten that hard, and actually they were just going to miss that target anyway. What's quite interesting is that although NHS England is saying, hey, we're going to have to water down the overall elective activity target for this year, they're saying, but the 65-week waits by March, so the long waiter target for this year, we're still going to hit that. Now, I think that's a pretty bold call, because sort of anecdotally speaking to quite a few trusts around the place, they're already saying, well, the 65-week target is looking a real stretch now. So, and bear in mind, the 18-month target, the 78-week target that they were supposed to hit in April, they still haven't hit, and it's now July. So they have, however, inserted the word virtually. We're going to virtually eliminate 65-week waiters. We're going to virtually eliminate. Well, it started off with 104-week waiters, and then they said, "Oh, well, we've eliminated 90% of the 18-month week waiters." So the word "virtually" could do quite a lot of heavy lifting. You know, I always, whenever I'm thinking about the long waiter conundrum, I go back to pre-COVID, when there were around 1,600 patients who had waited over a year. 1,600. And that was considered a really, really, really bad thing. There are now close to 380,000 patients who have waited over a year. So when it got down to kind of, well, there's only 10,000 patients who have waited over 18 months, and they're saying, well, we virtually eliminated it. It's like, hang on a minute, that's several times more than the number of patients who were waiting over a year before COVID, and that was considered a bad place. So I think that benchmark of 1,600 people waiting over a year is a bad place. It's like a nice benchmark to say, is it okay to say we virtually eliminated it? No, it's not really. It's a good thing. And as long as, you know, say a target is hit in April instead of March, or in July even instead of, then is, yeah, as long as things are going on the right sort of trajectory and things are heading in the right direction. And there is no doubt that NHS England and the NHS and trusts have done some remarkable work, considering everything that's been thrown at it, COVID, some ludicrous winters, some big flu seasons, and the industrial action. It is remarkable that the NHS has done as well as it's done. But let's not dress that up as we've hit all our targets when actually they haven't been hit.
Yeah, that seems fair enough. It just seemed bizarre to me that the ministerial line was, the reason we might miss our long waiters target, it's those junior doctors, which in fact they hadn't had kind of three of their strikes at that point. And then on Monday, when people were like, hey, might you miss your overall activity target because of these junior doctor strikes? They're like, never.
No, it does. No. The logic doesn't feel that sound after.
No. Well, it's going to be a continued big push on the electives. I think I was looking at the interim results for an outsourcing company this morning, and they were saying, like, oh yeah, our margin, they were giving it big to their investors, saying there's huge opportunities coming up on the outsourcing and insourcing for elective work, and like, yeah, margin's about 20-25%. So yeah, I think we'll see a lot happening in this space. Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Henry. Thank you, James. That's all for this week. Everybody, thanks for tuning in. The Health Check podcast should be back with my colleague Annabelle Collins next week. In the meantime, do tell a friend if you've enjoyed it. Any questions you want to email in, I'm on ben.clover@wilmingtonhealthcare.com. Hopefully we'll see you in another week. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.